Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello. Nature Now arrives as the weather seems to be slipping toward fall. This is Mary Robson, noticing that it's sweater weather for sure. Actual temperatures, however, for the last week still closely match recorded averages. High 60s daily, night temperatures cooling into the 40s. Summer isn't over. Take a look at this coming weekend. Noticeable changes I'm seeing are mostly brought on by the summer's dryness. Vine maples close to me show their leaves turning rapidly to brown and red and dropping off right off the tree, weeks ahead of their usual pattern. So when spring comes, we'll have to see how that all worked out. Well, we are going to start, as usual, with a mystery sound. You would be unlikely to hear the sound of this mammal. It would rather not be heard or seen. And our guest today, very fortunately, is Laurel Moulton, who has talked with us before. She works with Washington State University, Clallam County Extension, and has a job title that embraces, I think, multiple skills and realities, Regional Horticulture Specialist. Her curiosity and experience with both native and agricultural plants helps her fill that title. She also helps educate the master gardeners, which I know from experience is very, very satisfying. Today, we are going to talk with Laurel about a topic that has barely been touched in all 530 previous Nature Now shows. We are going to talk about bogs. We may not get bogged down, but if we do, we'll pull ourselves out. Welcome, Laurel. Hi.
Hi. Thanks, Mary, for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure all the way around. You have had some experience in studying bogs and their flora, starting on the East Coast. Could you bring us up to date on that?
Yeah, it was more than 20 years ago now. I had the fortune to be able to study inquilin populations in pitcher plants, in northern pitcher plants in a bog in western Massachusetts. And so the inquilins, those are actually insects that live inside the pitchers or breed inside the pitchers.
I thought those were carnivorous plants that would eat anything that fell in.
No, well, they do, but there's actually insects that can live, well, insects and other, you know, critters that can live and breed inside the pitchers. So there are specific mosquitoes like the pitcher plant mosquito and the pitcher plant midge that rely on those pitchers for their breeding grounds.
How in the heck does that work?
Well, the water in the pitcher of the northern pitcher plant is very similar to rainwater. So it's not going to dissolve those insects that fall in there by itself. It's actually the other things that live in the pitcher that help. So this pitcher plant mosquito larva helps break down other insects that fall in.
Wow.
There's bacteria that mineralize those nutrients from the broken down insect. And then there's these little aquatic, multi-celled, microscopic animals that take those mineralized nutrients and make them into a form that plants can take up, like nitrate and ammonium and phosphate.
So it takes at least a three-part system to take an insect that has arrived there and turn it into something that the plant can actually use.
Yeah, and that's kind of specific to this pitcher plant. It can be different in with different carnivorous plants.
It's still impressive.
I think so.
Well, it's the usual thing with the closer you get to something in nature, the more astonishing and miraculous it seems. And that seems very astonishing that there would be in a carnivorous plant an existing insect that goes in there to help and manages to survive and not be munched or dissolved. So you have studied pitcher plants in Massachusetts. In Washington bogs, we don't have them, correct?
That's correct. When I first came out here after college, I was determined that I was going to find pitcher plants in a local bog in Western Washington. And I never did. they aren't this far west.
Huh. It's like the beautiful red cardinal that didn't get across the Rockies. Those pitcher plants didn't make it here. But we do have some plants that are in bogs that do manage to get some help from insects. You described sundew as one of them.
We have the common sundew or round-leafed sundew in the bogs and fens around here. And those are very small plants that have stalked glands, mucilaginous glands, that secrete a sugary, sticky substance that attracts insects. And they get caught in that substance, and then they're dissolved by enzymes and those nutrients made available to the plants.
Amazing. We started by saying we were going to talk about bogs, and I think it would help maybe at this point to define a bog a little bit. What makes it different from a swamp?
Well, a bog is a type of wetland, but it's characterized by, number one, having a lot of sphagnum moss and the buildup of peat moss, which is kind of the semi-decomposed sphagnum moss. Uh-huh. And bogs don't get outside inputs from water except through rain.
So there's no stream exit and there's nothing leaving the bog. Everything is all there and it gets its water only from rain?
Yeah, typically they get it all or mostly from rain. So you wouldn't find a stream or groundwater influencing the community there.
Okay, which differs from a swamp, which does have intake of water and places for water to depart, right?
Yeah, I think there's all sorts of different wetlands. There's swamps and marshes. Fens are kind of the next closest wetland to a bog. And those do get terrestrial water or groundwater into them. And so they're a little bit more mineral rich. So that's, I didn't mention another characteristic of a bog is they're very nutrient poor.
Ah, that would affect everything that grows in or around them then.
Yeah, they have that. And that's why it's common to find carnivorous plants there and also other plants that may not be common in other locations.
Due to the absence of available minerals or other factors?
Bogs are they're nutrient poor and oftentimes they're very exposed, but then for part of the year at least, they're usually kind of mushy and inundated. I shouldn't say mushy and inundated. What's the right word for that?
But it's descriptive. We can
waterlogged. And so you have to have some pretty tough plants to survive.
Well, and one of the things that we're going to be doing is talking about Crowberry Bog near Forks, which has some unusual factors. And one of the things about bogs is you can't just wander in there going stomp, 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 stomp. They're rather fragile, right?
Yeah, they're extremely fragile environments. They're very rare in our area and they're ancient. So we really want to preserve them and keep them intact as much as we can. So even if you know where a bog is, it's not a good idea to go tromping around there.
You mentioned that you had on occasion carried wood stepping stones when you were able to be near or in a bog.
When we were conducting research at the Holly Bog in Western Massachusetts, when we had to get off the boardwalks, because that bog is actually has boardwalks that you can walk out on. But when we were on the bog surface, otherwise, we carried a kind of big pieces of plywood and we would toss those out in front of us and step on those. So it kind of distributes your weight like snowshoes would in the snow.
Aha. Uh-huh. Because you really are not wanting to crush something happening in the bog surface.
Right. Lots of people visiting a bog will make trails. It can destroy the sphagnum moss hummocks and other unique features of the bog. And it takes a long time for those to recover.
And at this point, you did mention that bogs are not as common in Western Washington. There are other places north of here where they are more common.
Yeah, bogs tend to be the most common in kind of northern cooler climates. Like they're very common up in Canada. There's some in Alaska. There's some bogs in northern states in the lower 48 states as well. But they just become a lot less common as you get further south.
Okay, and so we may just be on the tipping edge of where it's still cold enough for bogs, but there are not a lot of them as we go to California, for instance.
Yeah. I don't know if there's bogs in California. Maybe there are. I don't know.
Let's talk a little bit about the Crowberry Bog near Forks. If I wanted to wander over there and look at it, I couldn't, could I?
No, it's actually a protected area, and it's only open to researchers and, folks that are specifically have permits to work there and do
Okay.
research.
This is probably something that's very needed given that it is fragile and that one of the people researching found a peat core that they believe to be 16,000 years old.
Yeah, there was a study that included that location back in the 1970s, and they did a core of the peat there and found that it started forming around 16,000 years ago.
That is completely staggering. I know that we expect there to be old features in mountains and volcanoes, et cetera, but this is a land feature, and it seems quite surprising that it could have persisted that long as the sphagnum moss was breaking down and basically changing the character of the place so that it becomes a bog. But that is an incredible length of time.
Yeah, the bogs are very, very acidic, and so that leads to, as the sphagnum moss, the layers build up on top, and they're compressed below, it creates peat, and that's kind of a somewhat stable form of organic matter that, it takes hundreds or thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of years to build up any depth.
That's one of the things that makes a bog in this area a fragile environment.
Yep.
And these bogs are, this particular one, Crowberry Bog, is largely rain-fed.
Yeah, the Crowberry Bog is a rare example of a plateau bog, and these types of bogs, this is the first one that's been found this far south on the West Coast in the lower 48 states, but they are only found in other places that are near the ocean. So this is extremely rare in this area.
Aha. And you said it might be somewhat unique to the Western United States then?
Yeah, there's a couple of different types of bogs. They can form by the terrestrialization of a lake or a pond, and that's where sphagnum moss kind of builds up over a depression, a lake or a pond, and over many, many years, it will form a layer of peat on top of that water. In other places, the peat just builds up on the surface of the ground, and the peat kind of builds on itself because as there's more sphagnum moss, it'll hold water, and that just kind of allows the process to continue. And that's what causes these raised bogs, like domed bogs that are found more so in the north and kind of continental climates in the north, and then these plateau bogs that are found in marine influenced areas.
And you mentioned the fact that these are not, they're not heavily mineralized, but that the water itself, when tested, might show some salt.
Bogs as a whole are very low in minerals, whereas fens, since they have overland water feeding them or groundwater, they'll get the benefit of minerals from bedrock. But bogs, because they're only getting rainwater, they're very, very, they have very few minerals in them. But these plateau bogs that are influenced by salt spray might actually show salt buildup in them. So that would be one of few minerals that are found in higher levels.
That would affect always the types of flora that will grow in a bog.
Yeah.
And one of the things you mentioned was that there are a couple of sites inside Olympic National Park that are classified as bog or fen.
There's some botanical features that we often refer to as prairies, like Ahlstrom's Prairie and Roos's Prairie, that are on the coast in Olympic National Park. And when I was reading about those, it looks like Alstrom's prairie is classified as a fen. So it's a type of area that it has sphagnum moss and peat buildup, but it has groundwater or overland water influence. And then Alstrom's Roos's prairie that's just to the north of that is referred to as boggy or a bog. And so, but those two land features are kind of attached, so that it just demonstrates the complexity of wetlands. And, you know, whether it's a bog or a fen, you know, there could be a mixture of different types in one area.
Is that in an area that people might reach by a trail, or are they pretty much off by themselves?
The trail that goes out to Cape Olava from Lake Ozette goes through these prairies, or, you know, a bog and a fen. And so you can see them from there.
Yeah. Yeah. That trail, but I had no idea there was a fen in the area.
Yeah, that's what that open area is.
And these essentially have some of the features of the Crowberry Bog, but because Crowberry Bog has been studied extensively, we know a little bit more about its antiquity and a little bit more about what might be going on there, I assume. They're still being studied, yeah?
Yeah, I think both Alstrom's and Roos's prairies have also been studied. I just have read less about those.
Okay.
But they're also different because those prairies on the coast were probably more heavily influenced by people. First by our indigenous populations, and then by Alstrom and Roos, who took over those areas as homesteads. In that area, it's interesting because after the formation of Olympic National Park, those prairies have started to, shrubs and trees have started encroaching there.
Because there's no longer any, if there were management, it's not happening anymore.
Yeah, there's evidence that they may have been managed by fire. When white settlers came in, they certainly had livestock there. So when you remove those, you know, people visiting there frequently or keeping livestock or managing them to keep them open, then the trees and the shrubs have moved in pretty quickly.
In general, are there some types of fauna that are particular to bogs? I know we mentioned that we do not have pitcher plants here, but Crowberry itself has some rare plant communities, and I think a rare butterfly.
Yeah,
question mark.
Yeah, and in bogs, they definitely have different species of sphagnum moss and the buildup of peat, but they also oftentimes have ericaceous plants. So there might be bog laurel there. And yes, I was named after that type of laurel. You might find Labrador tea, you might find cranberries, and you might find this crowberry, which is also in that same plant family. Yeah, and then sundews, of course, are going to be common in these types of areas. And there's other herbaceous plants. In the crowberry bog, there's actually skunk cabbage that's found there.
Okay. Well, I'm awfully glad you weren't named after a skunk cabbage. And Crowberry, they have also found a rare butterfly.
Yeah, the recent analysis of Crowberry Bog has found three globally rare plant communities. It also has a rare macaw copper butterfly, and a couple different mosses that are rare in Washington State. So yeah, it's kind of a hot spot for rare and unusual plants.
Wow. We briefly mentioned the native cranberry, and I thought at this point, it might be a good idea to remark a little bit about cranberry production in Western Washington, boggy and swampy areas producing commercial cranberries. We're not the first place in terms of the amount of cranberries produced, but we're on the list, right?
Yeah, I think we're number five after Oregon State. There's some cranberry production that happens on our south coast here in Washington.
Basically, you just classify that as agriculture. It's not, we're not wandering out there picking native plants. That's a crop.
yeah, and in fact, it's a different species of cranberries. The cultivated one that we use here in America is Vaccinium macrocarpon, and which is much different, well, much different in size anyway from the native one, Vaccinium oxycoccus, which is a third of the size. They're tiny. It takes a lot of effort to collect enough. So just buy them bags.
Insurers, people want to fiddle around with that.
Yeah.
Thinking about bogs, could there have been other bogs here locally?
Yeah, a lot of wetlands, including bogs, are frequently kind of considered inconvenient wet spots, and some have been drained. I know in Squim, kind of in Northeast Squim, there's an area that has peat soil, and that was a wetland. I don't know if it was a fen or a bog that was drained with the introduction of agriculture here.
So changing the landscape to develop it is as hard on bogs as it is on other features. Wow. At this point, when we think about an existing bog, the best thing that could happen is that somebody leaves it alone and isn't trying to harvest something out of it. For instance, peat moss.
Yeah, peat moss is one of those, you know, it's a material that we've used for centuries in the garden and for other uses, but most people don't know that that's actually, technically it's a renewable resource, but it's renewable over tens of thousands of years. So in the human lifetime, no, it's not a renewable resource, and we should find other things to use in our gardens.
There is a good deal of it harvested, I think, in Eastern Canada. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. Yeah.
And the suggestion would be to get to know more about peat moss and perhaps not be collecting it for home use, perhaps. I'm sure that there are other things that have some of the same characteristics as peat moss, but it is so traditional, it's kind of hard for people to get it through their minds that, wait a minute, this may have taken hundreds or thousands of years to develop.
Yeah, it's just, you know, when things are available and we don't know much about them, we buy them. And there's some alternatives to peat moss, like composted forest products that includes bark and sawdust. It's, you know, composted, of course. And then coconut coir is another good example. I'm not sure where that falls in the sustainability spectrum, but that is another alternative.
Well, what we've determined here is that a real bog is basically, it needs to be treated gently because it's taken it a long time to arrive, and any kind of intervention with it could create an unsustainability. So hooray. And thank you for telling us more about Crowberry Bog, where we will not be going. And we need to remind listeners that it's there, but you might want to look it up on the internet rather than trying to get there with your boots on. So, Laurel, thank you so much for helping our knowledge of bogs.
I'd love to bring the Washington Natural Heritage Program to everybody's attention. They're the folks that did the work at Crowberry Bog, and they've been surveying and documenting other rare habitats around the state and conserving them in some cases. So this Crowberry Bog work was all due to their looking out for this type of thing.
Thank you so much. Well, we are going to leap into our mystery sound, which all of you have already figured out is a cougar. Observers near Diamond Point recently reported an August sighting of a cougar. This isn't verified, but it reflects the fact that cougars do live near humans on the Olympic Peninsula. They're primarily nocturnal and definitely elusive, but occasionally someone might see one by daylight locally. The many common names of cougars, painter, panther, ghost cat, reflect their long observation by humans and their presence in most of the Western Hemisphere. They range from the Yukon to the Andes, which is pretty amazing. They are obligate carnivores. Deer are their most common food here on the peninsula. And in size, They are the fourth largest feline worldwide. Their leg strength and their leaping ability make them excellent hunters, and they will essentially eat anything they can catch, even to prey as small as mice. Their presence helps regulate animal populations, and cougars can regulate the size of populations such as deer and elk, and this may affect how forests grow when there aren't as many ungulates eating the plants. For more information, check out the publications by Western Wildlife Outreach. Here's another great thing. Daryl and Lorna Smith and others have produced publications about predators, and their work specializes in defining them and describing their behavior scientifically. So look for Western Wildlife Outreach. And that is the end of our show for today as we head into September. Our song, well, we didn't want to get all bogged down, pardon me. So our song is Chopin's Prelude, Raindrops, which is what all bogs need. We know all of you are part of this eclectic and local program. We do it for you. Thanks to Nora Petrick for organizing the program on Zoom. And Nature Now airs Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, but the best place to look is the podcasts. They run at www.kptz.org.